Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions related to health and nutrition. We invite you to email us your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll endeavor to answer as many questions as we can during today's broadcast. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very good, very good.
Trying to stay warm.
Trying to stay warm. Completing my 30-day trial of the Whole 30 diet, and I'll be.
How's it going?
It's going really well. I have to say that I'm feeling really good. I'm feeling really balanced, I think is the word. Not mm-hmm. subject to cravings. Really enjoying the food. And, you know, my goal wasn't to lose weight, per se. I may have lost a couple of pounds, you know, maybe the like a little less on the love handles department. Yeah, it's working out really well. And I'm going to try and provide listeners with a little bit of a recap on that, a critique of some of the concepts behind the Whole 30. Which are interesting, but worth discussing because some of the assumptions that they make are just that, they're assumptions, and they may work for some people and may not work for others. But it's a very interesting program. And I think as a result, I think I've inspired a lot of people to try this type of diet, via social media, and actually the folks that I work with at the media group that helps me put together these newsletters and podcasts, a bunch of the staff are trying it.
Really? Look what you've started.
Yeah, you know what?
You have now made the Whole 30 in vogue.
Right. Well, I'm not solely responsible for it. It's a viral phenomenon, but I've what influence I wield, I've extended that. And so Alan, who's our producer, who actually takes these raw podcasts and turns them into polished products that are listener-ready, he's doing the Whole 30. And Allie, who prepares our newsletter, a shout-out to those guys at MMG.
Yeah.
She's actually going to be doing it next month. So, I think it's kind of interesting is that people are saying, hey, that's kind of interesting. I'll do the experiment, too. 30 days, that's not a whole lot of time to consecrate, and hopefully that'll, make a difference.
Right. That's great. That's terrific.
Yep.
I think one of the biggest influences of the Whole 30 is that you consider at the end of everything, all you're required to commit to is the 30 days.
Right.
And I think, hopefully by the end of that, everybody who's doing it just feels so good that they want to continue or they like the results they're seeing in the mirror or how their clothes are fitting and all of that.
In setting goals, it's very chunkable. So, the analogy I like to use is that I'm from California originally, so I only learned to ski later in life. So I was in my 40s, and I went to this ski resort. It was like a tiny ski resort in Connecticut, not much, a hill. But to me, it seemed like when I got up to the top of the hill on the ski lift, I felt like I was on top of Mount Everest. I was looking down that steep slope. It was probably like a 25-degree slope, but to me, it looked like, a steep cliff. And I was standing there with my skis, and I took a lesson, I had tried a few times to ski earlier in life, but this I was really going to nail it down. And so the instructor, he was very wise. He said, look, don't look down at the chalet down there, which looked like a little matchbox. It was all the way down the hill. He said, see those trees over there to the left? He says, they're not very far away. He says, your goal is to ski to those trees over there. And then we're going to turn you around, and then you're going to fix your eyes on the other side of the run and pick out another set of trees not too far down and ski to those. And then you'll turn and you'll go. And so that's how I learned how to ski. And, that's kind of the way it is with a lot of goals in life is you set.
People say, break it down into smaller steps.
Because we so often hear people say, do I have to eat like this for the rest of my life? It's like a life sentence. Oh, my God, there's no reprieve. So, I say, well, no, give it a shot. We say do it for a month, do it for 6 weeks. With some things like serious diseases, we'll say, hey, you really need to do a serious 90-day trial at the very least to see. You won't be cured, but at least it's likely that you'll feel better, and that may encourage you to re-up, So, and it
ameliorate some symptoms. Yeah.
So that's the deal. All right. So let's fire away with questions. What's going on today?
Okay. We've got an email from Gary. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I wonder what you think about a comparison between or a synergy between N-acetylcysteine and Dr. O'Hara's new RegActive as a glutathione producer or precursor. Or perhaps NAC has effects and benefits other than glutathione enhancement. And it appears that RegActive also has general probiotic effects that NAC does not.
Yep.
If you were to choose just one,
Oh, this is from his question. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit I think it's a little bit of a, almost like a wonky question, because RegActive is a probiotic that's introduced by the people who make Dr. O'Hara's. That's a really nice complement to the original Dr. O'Hara's probiotic, because RegActive is a series of probiotics that produce glutathione in the gastrointestinal tract. And that's kind of cool, because it's like, you know, you could take glutathione by mouth, but it won't be that readily absorbed. It'll often be broken down. So it's nice if you can get something that actually produces this important antioxidant in your system, inside of you. And that's actually the way a lot of nutrients get produced in the body. We know that certain B vitamins, vitamin K, for example, valuable compounds like butyrate, are synthesized by the bacteria in our gastrointestinal tract, and it's actually better to get the bacteria to make them than to take them orally in supplements. It seems to work better. So it's a really kind of ingenious idea. We're getting glutathione made endogenously in the body. And N-acetylcysteine is actually a building block for glutathione. With enough NAC in the body will produce more glutathione. So it sounds like that's going to be a great synergy that could work well together. So I can't say, you know, one is better than the other, or, you know, I don't think any studies have been done, you know, looking at one, then looking at the other, then looking at the additive effect. That's a great idea for a study to see if even more glutathione is produced than with either alone. You know, there'd probably be four arms of the experiment, a placebo arm, an NAC arm, a RegActive arm, and then one arm where participants are taking both together, and then measure glutathione. Anybody about $10 million?
Because
that's what these studies can be pricey. So, I mean, seriously, it's just to mount a scientific study is a big deal. But, you know, it's a good, that's a good concept. And our, you know, obviously we have wonky listeners.
Right. And you know, Gary, you could take both. You know, I don't think you'd have to choose between one or the other, because, as he makes mention, the Dr. O'Hara's also has the benefit of having a probiotic, which is nice.
Yeah.
Thank you for your question, Gary. Okay, let's see here.
That's Gary A., right? Gary A.? We won't say his last name, but that's Gary A.?
Yes, it is.
Oh, he always has good questions.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, okay.
We've got a question from Gabby.
Okay.
Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I think this will prove an easy one for you. I'm looking to get help for my 13-year-old daughter. After she gets over a cold, she ends up with the lingering cough, and following a sports competition, she has a wheezing spell. The doctor diagnosed this as asthma. Said the only prevention and treatment is the use of steroid medication. I am reluctant to go with this approach. You seem to have a solution for almost everything. Hopefully you can offer some insight into this situation.
What do you think, Layla? You think that's an easy question?
No, not at all.
It's not. It's not really. It really is not an easy question.
Not at all.
Because it's a challenging problem, is, you know, airway disease and asthma. And clearly there's a post-infectious component to this, where the tissue is irritated and inflamed after an infection, and then it becomes hyperreactive to physical stimuli like cold, for example, and possibly to environmental influences like smoke or potentially perfume, fragrances, pollens. And then you have, this is actually the way that sometimes people develop chronic asthma or chronic bronchitis, is that after an infection, well, okay, the infection goes away, but the inflammation is left, and then subsequently it becomes a chronic problem. And then it's a vicious cycle because having inflammation and asthma may set the stage for a subsequent infection. So, you know, why don't you start with some ideas around asthma?
First of all, because it's inflammatory, you know, I would want to assess a 13-year-old diet, mm-hmm. a girl. But, you know, I would be very, first of all, I would be interested to know if there are any food allergies, intolerances that may be contributing to the inflammation.
It's like, so for example, a dairy allergy, very common in asthmatics.
Gluten
potentially.
I would also look at the essential fatty acid profile of a 13-year-old girl.
And especially in 13-year-olds.
What kind of diet?
Yeah, we often do that.
Make certain assumptions.
We often see that in, you know, especially kids. You know, I got to tell you, I was a really finicky eater, and I didn't eat any fish until I was about 15. So I probably had horrible essential fatty acids. And, you know, sometimes we see kids and they just don't eat fish. I mean, many kids who come from more enlightened families are fish is introduced early on and they accept it. But there's some people who, you know, just don't eat any fish. They have no omega-3 fatty acids. That creates a pro-inflammatory state.
Yeah. And the addition of any other preteen or tween foods, you can imagine the amount of omega-6 fatty acids, you know, the ratio of 3 to 6 is going to be off and very pro-inflammatory. That would be one thing. I think the addition of a fish oil, magnesium. Now, I'm not against medical management here, certainly, and of course it would be appropriate if the situation is acute or becomes acute. That could be life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. It's
not one or the other.
Look, sometimes steroids are necessary.
I would not poo-poo medication here because asthma is serious.
Sometimes steroids are necessary, and we agree.
Yeah.
But you actually want to try to avoid steroids because, especially in a young kid, even the amount that's absorbed through the lungs has a bit of a growth inhibiting effect. So we want to minimize dependency on steroids in kids. Now, of course, what that may amount to, you know, half an inch. It's not really, may not be that consequential ultimately. But, you know, it's best to see if you can manage this naturally. That's always our goal. So what are some of the things that do help asthma? Well, as you say, diet, omega-3 fatty acids, to some extent magnesium, because there's a bronchospasm component to this. One of the ignored facts about asthma is that the bacteria that cause asthma don't necessarily just come from the lungs. They actually come from the nasal tract. And so we like to use clear nasal spray, Xeliar, because there are biofilms that form in the nasal tract, and they act as staging areas for the bacteria that flow via gravity deep into the lungs and create an alert. It's almost like you're allergic to your own bacteria. You don't actually have to have a full-blown infection for the body to develop an inflammatory response in the presence of foreign bacteria. So clear nasal spray 4 times daily, that's an important part of our regimen. One of the new things that I'm recommending for asthma is something called black seed oil, which is actually black cumin seed oil. It seems to have really good anti-inflammatory properties. Ginkgo biloba, although it's a platelet inhibitor, that activity of inhibiting something called PAF, platelet activating factor, seems to have a good effect on lung inflammation. And we might use other anti-inflammatories, you know, familiar with curcumin and boswellin. Higher doses of, vitamin E.
What would you think of using NAC?
Oh, absolutely, because NAC is
asthma.
NAC is a mucolytic. Yeah. It breaks up mucus, and it's a thinning effect on thick tenacious
mucus. What would you
think,
then, in this case of asthma in a 13-year-old using something like oregacillin?
Because it would provide sort of antibiotic coverage, it's a mild antibiotic, and that might be helpful in suppressing the growth of harmful bacteria. Olive leaf or oregacillin, any one of the natural botanical anti-microbials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all right. Gabby, your daughter needs a workup, most definitely, to see anything in her diet that may be promoting any inflammation. But
was it as simple as Gabby thought? I mean, she's complimenting us on the one hand, but in some ways she's sort of saying, yeah, this is just like rolling out of bed for you guys. I mean, we're not even going to you're not even going to break a sweat on this. I have confidence in it.
I'm breaking a sweat.
Right. This could actually be the subject of, several office visits where we explore different possibilities, dietarily, mm-hmm. supplementarily, and it's also something that doesn't resolve instantaneously. It may take two or three seasons before we see a reduction in infections. Of course, we have to look at the aspect of why is this kid getting sick all the time? Does she have an inadequate mm-hmm. level of vitamin D or inadequate zinc? We have to look at things that support the immune system. You've been really happy with your patients with something called V-Clear, which seems to really stop a lot mm-hmm. of colds dead in their tracks.
And that's firsthand. I've been using it. It's been amazing. This is the second time I'm using it. It's almost like I don't have a cold.
What is it? What is it exactly? It's an herbal thing, right?
Yeah, it's an herbal. It's Pelargonium sedoides, which is African geranium.
Okay. Okay.
And it's very good for suppressing cold symptoms. Mm-hmm. It could also be good for bronchitis.
Mm-hmm.
And just keeping the immune system well.
And we also a product called Viracid. It's V-I-R-A-C-I-D, which has, astragalus, and it has echinacea and a lot of things that support immunity. So that mm-hmm. may be something to take over time. And then there's transfer factor for people who get a lot of respiratory infections. I often prescribe that. That's transfers passive immunity from, it's actually derived from colostrum, but it helps mm-hmm. young calves, reduces their rate of infection, and it also works to some extent in humans by transferring these immunoglobulins, which are protective against infection.
Yeah. I also love vitamin C mm-hmm. daily, but especially during cold and flu season. I also like quercetin.
Okay.
And for the even more allergic type symptoms.
Absolutely. The late Dr. Richard Ashe, who some of our listeners may not know, passed away recently. He was a co-host. It wasn't on my program, but he was a fellow host with me on WOR. He was always really big on quercetin, really high doses of quercetin, maybe 6 or 8 capsules of quercetin for people who were trying to create what he called a steroid bridge. In other words, mm-hmm. weaning off of steroids. He felt that quercetin had a milder but steroid-like effect to help mm-hmm. suppress allergic symptoms or inflammatory symptoms. So that's interesting that you mentioned that. He was a big fan of quercetin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gabby, best of luck with your daughter. Okay. We have an email from Tom. Tom writes, Dr. Hoffman, what do you think about charcoal for gas and bloating? I know it can absorb or interfere with medicines, but can it still be taken as long as it's a few hours apart? My wife has a hiatal hernia and has gas after eating.
Mm-hmm.
She's been taking Carafate, which her doctor prescribes, and she takes Beano once in a while, which doesn't seem to be effective. Would a probiotic be good? Would you recommend one or anything else that would be helpful?
Oh, there's a whole dissertation on gas right there. I will mention that this charcoal thing is one of the oldest things around for treatment of stomach distress. And my grandfather used to use charcoal, and he was like an old, from Poland and Europe. Eastern European Jew, and that was a remedy. The problem with charcoal is, it is a burnt hydrocarbon, so I'm a little bit concerned, is there a potential for, even carcinogenicity of charcoal, because we tell people not to have char-broiled steak. That's number one.
Right.
But also, it does relieve symptoms, but that it does so mm-hmm. by absorbing, it's kind of like a sponge. It absorbs a lot of things. And it might interfere with the absorption of nutrients, as this person says. For gas, diet change, obviously less fermentable food. We test our patients for SIBO, which is small intestine bacterial overgrowth, which turns you into a, you know, turns you into a fermenting vat with a lot of production of hydrogen and CO2 and methane. You know, it's kind of like global warming in your gastrointestinal tract.
And you know, Dr. Hoppen, you used to give an example a few years back of take a container and put cereal in it and put milk in it and then cover it, put the cap on.
Yeah, and then put it by the windowsill in the sun.
Yeah.
And then you'll open the top and it'll be like, you know, you'll get a pop because...
Pop.
Yep, because of the pressure that forms from the gas production. And that's what's happening in a lot of people's guts.
Yeah.
Not happy guts.
Yeah, not happy guts. Oh, yeah. So definitely a workup there. And, you know, I just want to say to Tom that the hiatal hernia is not necessarily the cause of gas after eating. Typically, I think a hiatal hernia would be more a cause of reflux. What do you think, Dr. Hoppen?
It could be either.
Hernia
is when you have sometimes an incompetent sphincter that closes, that keeps the stomach contents from either regurgitating upwards, which could be liquid or it could be gas. And so the thing about hiatal hernia is such a hype because they'll do a test on you and say, oh, you have a hiatal hernia. Okay, now take this drug. Well, if you do, say you took just the whole population of people over 50, you'd probably find that the majority of them have what might be termed some degree of hiatal hernia. So it's not all about what they see structurally. It doesn't mean that you're defective or that you have a serious medical condition. It's just it's an anatomical variant that sometimes gets worse as you age. And a lot of people are
asymptomatic.
Exactly. They just have it, you know, and it's like... So to me, it's kind of like, you know, something that they got to say to justify doing an endoscopy, where they say, well, you're fine, but you have a hiatal hernia. Okay, well, found something. But that doesn't explain it.
Yeah. Okay. Other things, besides checking for SIBO and all that and possible food allergies and the fermentable foods going on a very, you know, anti-fermentation diet is often helpful. That can help the belly. Taking something like peppermint is helpful. It's wonderful for gas and bloating. It's also antimicrobial.
Just to keep in mind, it's helpful for lower gas, but it actually loosens the sphincter, the upper sphincter. So if you're burping, it's not the best thing. But if you're having a lot of flatulence and lower abdominal distension, peppermint or spasm, peppermint's good. So you just have to distinguish between those two. It's peppermint's for low down. Ginger's more effective for high up.
Yeah, that will enhance the gastric emptying.
Yeah.
Tri salts are also helpful.
Okay.
Tri salts can also be helpful as like a bicarb.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly, because they're very alkaline, so they may have an antacid effect, and they're better than taking just sodium bicarb because they're balanced. They actually have other things in them. All right. This is the point at which we generally pause because, as our listeners know, we divide these podcasts into two parts. So if you're desirous of hearing more, please turn to part two. And, Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to hear in part two.
Can I check my vitamin D status with an at-home via mail kit?
Okay. We'll tackle that question when we return with part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.